of really living, even if living fully can sometimes be harder than not. You can feel your feelings privately or with Margot, or here with me. You can let them out in the adult sphere, and doing that might allow you to be more alive with your kids. It might be a different way of keeping your shit together for them. It might even be confusing for them if Gabe is never mentioned. And allowing yourself to rage or cry or sit with the despair at times might be more manageable if Gabe was given some air in your household and not tucked away in a box in the proverbial attic. John shakes his head. I don't want to be like Margot, he says. She cries at the slightest things. Sometimes it seems like she'll never stop crying, and I can't live that way. It seems like nothing has changed for her, and at some point, you have to make a decision to move on. I've chosen to move on. Margot hasn't. I picture Margot sitting on the couch near Wendell, hugging my favorite pillow, and telling him how alone she feels in her pain, how she's bearing it all herself, while her husband is in his closed-off world. And then I think about how alone John must feel, watching his wife's pain and not being able to bear the sight of it. I know it looks that way, I say finally. But I wonder if part of why Margot is like this is that she's been doing double duty. Maybe all of this time, she's been crying for both of you. John's forehead furrows. Then he looks down at his lap. A few tears land on his black designer jeans. Slowly at first, then quickly, like a waterfall, faster than he can wipe them. And finally, he stops trying. These are the tears he's been holding in for the past 6 years, or maybe more than 30. While he's crying, it occurs to me that what I'd seen as a theme with John, the argument with Margot about letting their daughter have a cell phone, the back and forth with me about using it in my office, had far deeper meaning than I'd realized. I remember holding hands at the Lakers game with my son. Enjoy it while it lasts. And John's comment when he arrived today. You win, the pleasure of my company. But perhaps he won the pleasure of mine. After all, he chose to come here today and tell me all of this. I think, too, about how there are many ways to defend oneself from the unspeakable. Here's one. You split off unwanted parts of yourself, hide behind a false self, and develop narcissistic traits. You say, yeah, this catastrophic thing has happened, but I'm A-okay. Nothing can touch me because I'm special, a special surprise. When John was a boy, wrapping himself in the memory of his mother's delight was a way to shield himself from the horror of life's utter unpredictability. He may have comforted himself this way as an adult, too, clinging to how special he was after Gabe died. Because the one certainty that John can count on in this world is that he is a special person surrounded by idiots. Through his tears, John says that this is exactly what he didn't want to happen, that he didn't come here to have a breakdown. But I assure him that he's not breaking down. He's breaking open. Chapter 39, How Humans Change. Theories involving stages abound in psychology. No doubt because their order, clarity, and predictability are appealing. Anyone who has taken an introductory psychology course has likely encountered the developmental stage models posited by Freud, Jung, Erikson, Piaget, and Maslow. But there's one stage model I keep in mind nearly every minute of every session. The stages of change. If therapy is about guiding people from where they are now to where they'd like to be, we must always consider, how do humans actually change? In the 1980s, a psychologist named James Prochaska developed the Trans-Theoretical Model of Behavior Change, TTM, based on research showing that people generally don't just do it, as Nike or a New Year's resolution might have it, but instead tend to move through a series of sequential stages that look like this. Stage 1, pre-contemplation. Stage 2, contemplation. Stage 3, Preparation. Stage 4. Action. Stage 5. Maintenance. So let's say you want to make a change. Exercise more. End a relationship. Or even try therapy for the first time. Before you get to that point, you're in the first stage, pre-contemplation, which is to say you're not even thinking about changing. Some therapists might liken this to denial, meaning that you don't realize you might have a problem. When Charlotte first came to me, she presented herself as a social drinker. I realized that she was in the pre-contemplation stage, as she talked about her mother's tendency to self-medicate with alcohol, but failed to see any connection to her own alcohol use. When I challenged her on this, she shut down, got irritated. People my age go out and drink, or engaged in whataboutery, the practice of diverting attention from the difficulty under discussion by raising a different problematic issue. Never mind X, what about Y? Of course, therapists aren't persuaders. We can't convince an anorexic to eat. We can't convince an alcoholic not to drink. We can't convince people not to be self-destructive. Because for now, the self-destruction serves them. What we can do is try to help them understand themselves better and show them how to ask themselves the right questions until something happens, either internally or externally, that leads them to do their own persuading. It was Charlotte's car accident and DUI that moved her into the next stage, contemplation. Contemplation is rife with ambivalence. If pre-contemplation is denial, contemplation might be likened to resistance. Here, the person recognizes the problem, is willing to talk about it, and isn't opposed, in theory, to taking action, but just can't seem to get herself to do it. So while Charlotte was concerned by her DUI and the subsequent mandate to participate in an addiction program, which she grudgingly attended and only after failing to take the course in time and having to hire a lawyer at great expense to get her deadline extended, she wasn't ready to make any changes to her drinking. People often start therapy during the contemplation stage. A woman in a long-distance relationship says that her boyfriend keeps delaying his planned move to her city, and she acknowledges that he's probably not coming, but she won't break up with him. A man knows that his wife has been having an affair, but when we talk about it, he comes up with excuses for where she might have been when she's not answering her texts, so that he doesn't have to confront her. Here, people procrastinate or self-sabotage as a way to stave off change, even positive change, because they're reluctant to give something up without knowing what they'll get in its place. The hiccup at this stage is that change involves the loss of the old and the anxiety of the new. Although often maddening for friends and partners to witness, this hamster wheel is part of the process. People need to do the same thing over and over a seemingly ridiculous number of times before they're ready to change. Charlotte talked about trying to cut back on her drinking, about having 2 glasses of wine each night instead of 3, or skipping cocktails at brunch if she would be drinking again at dinner, and of course, after dinner. She could acknowledge the role that alcohol was playing in her life, its anxiety-muting effects, but she couldn't find an alternative way to manage her feelings, even with medication prescribed by a psychiatrist. To help with her anxiety, we decided to add a second therapy session each week. During this time, she drank less, and for a while, she believed that this would be enough to control her drinking. But coming twice a week created its own problems. Charlotte was once again convinced that she was addicted to me, so she went back to the once-a-week schedule. When, in an opportune moment, say, after she'd mentioned getting drunk on a date, I'd bring up the idea of an outpatient treatment program, she'd shake her head. No way. Those programs make you stop completely, she'd say. I want to be able to have a drink at dinner. It's socially awkward not to drink when everyone else is. It's socially awkward getting drunk, too, I'd say. To which she'd reply, yeah, but I'm cutting back. And by then, it was true. She was cutting back. And she was reading up on addiction online, landing her in stage 3. Preparation. For Charlotte, It was hard to concede the lifelong fight she'd been in with her parents. I won't change, Mom and Dad, until you treat me the way I want to be treated. She'd made a subconscious bargain that she'd change her habits only if her parents changed theirs. A lose-lose pact if there ever was one. In fact, her relationship with her parents couldn't change until she had something new to bring to it. 2 months later, Charlotte waltzed in, unpacked the contents of her bag onto the arms of her throne, and said, "So I have a question. Did I know of any good outpatient alcohol treatment programs?" She had entered stage 4, action. In the action stage, Charlotte dutifully spent 3 nights per week in an addiction treatment program, using the group as a substitute for the wine drinking she used to do at that time. She stopped drinking entirely. The goal, of course, is to get to the final stage, maintenance, which means that the person has maintained the change for a significant period. That's not to say that people don't backslide, like in a game of chutes and ladders. Stress or certain triggers for the old behavior, a particular restaurant, a call from an old drinking buddy, can result in relapse. This stage is hard because the behaviors people want to modify are embedded in the fabric of their lives. People with addiction issues, whether that addiction is to a substance, drama, negativity, or self-defeating ways of being, tend to hang out with other addicts. By the time a person is in maintenance, she can usually get back on track with the right support. Without wine or vodka, Charlotte was able to focus better, her memory improved, and she felt less tired and more motivated. She applied to graduate school. She got involved with a charitable organization for animals that she felt passionate about. She was able to talk with me about her difficult relationship with her mother for the first time in her life and begin to interact with her in a calmer, less reactive way. She stayed away from friends who invited her out to have just one birthday drink. Because you only turn 27 once, right? Instead, she spent the night of her birthday with a new group of friends who served her her favorite meal and toasted her with a creative assortment of festive non-alcoholic drinks. But there was one addiction she couldn't quite kick. The dude. Full disclosure, I disliked the dude. His swagger, his dishonesty, his dicking Charlotte around, literally and figuratively. 1 week he was with his girlfriend, the next he wasn't. 1 month he was with Charlotte, the next he wasn't. "I'm on to you," I wanted my look to say, when I opened the waiting room door and saw him sitting near Charlotte. I felt protective, like the mommy dog in the driver's seat in the car commercial. But I stayed out of the fray. Charlotte would often wiggle her thumbs in the air while narrating the latest installment. And then I said, and then he's like, and then I'm like, "You had this conversation in text?" I asked, surprised, the first time she did this. When I suggested that discussing the state of their relationship via text might be limiting, you can't look into somebody's eyes or take someone's hand to offer reassurance even though you're upset, she replied, "Oh no, we use emojis too." I thought of the deafening silence and twitching foot that clued me into boyfriend's desire to break up. Had we been texting about the movie tickets that night, he might have waited months more to tell me. But with Charlotte, I knew I sounded like an old fogey. Her generation wasn't going to change, so I'd have to change to keep up with the times. Today, Charlotte's eyes are red. She found out on Instagram that the dude is back with his supposedly ex-girlfriend. "He keeps saying he wants to change, but then this happens," she says, sighing. "Do you think he'll ever change?" I think about the stages of change, where Charlotte is, where the dude might be, and about how Charlotte's father's constant disappearing act is being replayed with the dude. It's hard for her to accept that while she might change, other people might not. "He won't change, will he?" she says. "He may not want to change," I say gently. "And your father might not either." Charlotte squeezes her lips together, as if considering a possibility that had never occurred to her before. After all of her efforts to try to get these men to love her the way she wants to be loved, she can't change them because they don't want to change. This is a familiar scenario in therapy. A patient's boyfriend doesn't want to stop smoking pot and watching video games on weekends. A patient's child doesn't want to study harder for tests at the expense of doing musical productions. A patient's spouse doesn't want to travel less for work. Sometimes the changes you want in another person aren't on that person's agenda, even if he tells you they are. But, she says, then stops herself. I watch her, sensing the shift happening inside her. I keep trying to get them to change, she says, almost to herself. I nod. He won't change, so she'll have to. Every relationship is a dance. The dude does his dance steps, approach, retreat, and Charlotte does hers, approach, get hurt. That's how they dance. But once Charlotte changes her steps, one of two things will happen. The dude will be forced to change his steps so that he doesn't trip and fall down, or he'll simply walk off the dance floor and find somebody else's feet to stomp on. Charlotte's first drink after 4 months of sobriety happened on Father's Day, when her dad was supposed to fly into town to be with her, but canceled at the last minute. That was 3 months ago. She didn't like that dance, so she changed her steps. She hasn't had a drink since. I need to stop seeing the dude, she says now. I smile as if to say, that sounds familiar. No, really, I mean it this time, she says, but she smiles too. It's been her mantra for months while in preparation. Can I change the time of my appointment? She asks. Today, she's ready for action. Of course, I say, recalling that I'd suggested this before so that Charlotte wouldn't have to sit with the dude in the waiting room each week. But Charlotte hadn't been ready to consider it. I offer her a different day and time, and she puts the appointment into her phone. At the end of our session, Charlotte gathers up her myriad belongings, walks to the door, and as always, stops, stalling. Well, see you on Monday, she whispers, knowing we've pulled one over on the dude, who will likely wonder why Charlotte's not there at their regular Thursday time. Let him wonder, I think. As Charlotte heads down the hallway, the dude comes out of his session, and Mike and I nod hello, poker-faced. Maybe the dude told Mike about the girlfriend, and they spent the session talking about his tendency to juggle people, to mislead, to cheat. Oh, so that's his issue, Charlotte once said after he'd done this to her twice. Or maybe the dude didn't mention it to Mike at all. Maybe he's not ready to change. Or maybe he's just not interested in changing. When I bring this up in my consultation group the next day, Ian says simply, Lori, three words, not your patient. And I realize that, like Charlotte, I need to release the dude too. Chapter 40. Fathers. During a belated New Year's cleaning, I come across my grad school coursework on the Austrian psychiatrist Viktor Frankl. Scanning my notes, I begin to remember his story. Frankl was born in 1905, and as a boy, he became intensely interested in psychology. By high school, he began an active correspondence with Freud. He went on to study medicine and lecture on the intersection of psychology and philosophy, or what he called logotherapy, from the Greek word logos, or meaning. Whereas Freud believed that people are driven to seek pleasure and avoid pain, his famous pleasure principle, Frankl maintained that people's primary drive isn't toward pleasure, but toward finding meaning in their lives. He was in his 30s when World War II broke out, putting him, a Jew, in jeopardy. Offered immigration to the United States, he turned it down, so as not to abandon his parents. And a year later, the Nazis forced Frankl and his wife to have her pregnancy terminated. In a matter of months, he and other family members were deported to concentration camps. And when Frankl was finally freed, 3 years later, he learned that the Nazis had killed his wife, his brother, and both of his parents. Freedom under these circumstances might have led to despair. After all, the hope of what awaited Frankl and his fellow prisoners upon their release was now gone. The people they cared about were dead, their families and friends wiped out. But Frankl wrote what became an extraordinary treatise on resilience and spiritual salvation, known in English as Man's Search for Meaning. In it, he shares his theory of logotherapy as it relates not just to the horrors of concentration camps, but also to more mundane struggles. He wrote, "Everything can be taken from a man, but one thing, the last of the human freedoms, to choose one's attitude in any given set of circumstances." Indeed, Frankl remarried, had a daughter, published prolifically, and spoke around the world until his death at age 92. Rereading these notes, I thought of my conversations with Wendell. Scribbled in my grad school spiral were the words, reacting versus responding equals reflexive versus chosen. We can choose our response, Frankl was saying, even under the specter of death. The same was true of John's loss of his mother and son, Julie's illness, Rita's regrettable past, and Charlotte's upbringing. I couldn't think of a single patient to whom Frankl's ideas didn't apply, whether it was about extreme trauma or an interaction with a difficult family member. More than 60 years later, Wendell was saying I could choose too, that the jail cell was open on both sides. I particularly liked this line from Frankl's book. Between stimulus and response, there is a space. In that space is our power to choose our response. In our response lies our growth and our freedom. I'd never emailed Wendell for anything other than scheduling issues, but I was so stunned by the parallel that I wanted to share it with him. I pulled up his email and typed, "This is what we were talking about. The trick, I suppose, is to find that elusive space." A few hours later, he replied, "I've always appreciated Frankl. Beautiful quote. See you Wednesday." It was typical Wendell. Warm and genuine, but clearly stating that therapy takes place face to face. I remembered our first phone call, when he'd said almost nothing, and how surprisingly interactive he was once we met. Still, I carried around his reply in my head all week. I could have sent that quote to various friends who would have appreciated it too, but it wouldn't have been the same. Wendell and I existed in a separate universe, where he saw me in ways that even those close to me didn't. Of course, it's also true that my family and friends saw aspects of me that Wendell would never see. But nobody would quite understand the subtext of my email as precisely as Wendell would. The following Wednesday, Wendell brings up the email. He tells me that he shared the quote with his wife, who, he says, is going to use it for a talk she's giving. He's never mentioned his wife, though I know everything about her from my long-ago Google binge. "What does your wife do?" I ask, as if I haven't seen her LinkedIn profile. He tells me about her work at a nonprofit. "Oh, interesting," I reply, but the word interesting sounds unnaturally high-pitched. Wendell watches me. I quickly change the subject. For a split second, I think about what I might do if I were the therapist here. Sometimes I want to say, "I wouldn't do it that way," but I know that's like backseat driving. I need to be the patient, which means I need to relinquish control. It may seem like the patient controls the session, deciding what to say or not, setting the agenda or topic, but therapists pull the strings in our own ways, in what we say or don't say, what we respond to or hold on to for later, what we give attention to and what we don't. Later in the session, I'm talking about my father. I tell Wendell that he'd been in the hospital again due to his heart condition, and though he's okay now, I'm afraid of losing him. I'm aware in a new way of just how frail he is, and I'm starting to absorb the reality that he won't be here forever. "I can't picture a world without him in it," I say. "I can't imagine not being able to call and hear his voice, or ask his advice, or laugh together about something we both find funny." I think about how there's nothing in the world like laughing with my dad. I think about how knowledgeable he is on almost any topic, and how fully he loves me, and how kind he is, not just to me, but to everyone. The first thing people say about my father isn't how smart or funny he is, though he is both. The first thing they say is, He's so sweet. I tell Wendell about the time I was in college on the East Coast, missing home and unsure if I wanted to stay there. My father heard the pain in my voice and got on a plane and flew 3,000 miles to sit with me on a park bench across from my dorm in the cold winter weather and just listen. He listened to me for 2 more days, and I felt better, and he went home. I haven't thought about this in years. I also recount what happened this past weekend after my son's basketball game. As the boys ran off to celebrate their victory, my father took me aside and told me that he'd just been at a friend's funeral the day before. After the funeral, he explained, he'd gone up to the friend's daughter, now in her 30s, and said, "Your father was so proud of you. Every conversation we had, he'd say, 'I'm so proud of Christina,' and he'd tell me about all you were doing." This was absolutely true, but Christina was shocked. "He never told me that," she said, bursting into tears. My father was floored, until he realized that he wasn't sure if he'd told me how he felt about me. Had he done it at all, or enough? "So," my father said outside the gym, "I want to make sure that I've told you how proud of you I am. I want to make sure you know." He said it in such a shy way, obviously uncomfortable having this kind of interaction. He was used to listening to others, but keeping his emotional world to himself. "I know," I said, because my father had communicated his pride to me in countless ways, though I wasn't always listening as well as I should have been. But that day I couldn't help hearing the subtext. "I'm going to die sooner rather than later." We stood there, the two of us hugging and crying as people passing by tried not to stare, because we both knew that this was the beginning of my father's goodbye. "As your eyes are opening, his are beginning to close," Wendell says now. And I think about how bittersweet but true that is. My awakening is happening at an opportune moment. "I'm so glad I have this time with him, and that it can be so meaningful," I say. "I wouldn't want him to abruptly die one day and feel like it's too late, that I waited too long for us to really see each other." Wendell nods, and I feel queasy. All of a sudden, I remember that Wendell's father had died 10 years ago very unexpectedly. In my Google search, I'd come across his father's obituary after I read the story of his death in his mother's family interview. Apparently, Wendell's father had been in seemingly perfect health when he'd collapsed at dinner. I wonder if my talking about my father this way might be painful for him. I also worry that if I say any more, I'll give away how much I know. So I pull back, ignoring the fact that therapists are trained to listen for what patients aren't saying. A few weeks later, Wendell comments that for the past couple of sessions, I seem to have been editing myself. Ever since, he adds, I sent him the Viktor Frankl quote and he'd mentioned his wife. He wonders, what would we therapists do without the word wonder to broach a sensitive topic? How the mention of his wife has affected me. "I haven't really thought about that," I say. "It's true. I've been focused on hiding my internet search." I look at my feet, then at Wendell's. Today's socks are a blue chevron pattern. When I lift my head, I see that Wendell is looking at me with his right eyebrow raised. And then I realize what Wendell is getting at. He thinks that I'm jealous of his wife, that I want him all to myself. This is called romantic transference, a common reaction patients have to their therapists. But the idea that I have a crush on Wendell strikes me as hilarious. I look at Wendell in his beige cardigan and khakis and funny socks, his green eyes staring back at me. For a second, I imagine what it must be like to be married to Wendell. In a photo I'd found of him and his wife, they were at a charity event, arm in arm and all dressed up, Wendell smiling at the camera and his wife looking at him adoringly. I remember feeling a twinge of envy when I saw that photo. Not because I was envious of his wife, but because they seemed to have the kind of relationship I wanted for myself, with someone else. But the more I deny the romantic transference, the less Wendell will believe me. The lady doth protest too much. There are about 20 minutes left in the session. Even as a patient, I can feel the rhythm of the hour. and I know that this facade can't last forever. There's only one thing to do. I Googled you, I say, looking away. I stopped stalking boyfriend, and I ended up stalking you. When you mentioned your wife, I already knew all about her. And your mother. I pause, especially mortified by this last part. I read that long interview with your mom. I get ready for, I don't know what, something bad to happen? A tornado to enter the room and alter our connection in some intangible but irreparable way. I wait for everything to feel distant, different, changed between us. But instead, the opposite happens. It feels as though the storm came in, passed through the room, and left not ruins, but a clearing in its wake. I feel lighter, relieved of a burden. Sharing difficult truths might come with a cost, the need to face them. But there's also a reward. Freedom. The truth releases us from shame. Wendell nods, and we sit there in a wordless conversation. Me. I'm sorry, I shouldn't have done that. That was so invasive. Him. It's okay. I understand. It's natural to be curious. Me. I'm happy for you, for the loving family that you have. Him. Thank you. I hope you will have this one day too. And then we have a version of that conversation aloud. We also talk about my curiosity, why I kept it a secret, what it was like to hold that secret and also know so much about him, what I imagined would happen between us if I revealed it, and how it feels now that I have. And because I'm a therapist, or maybe because I'm a patient and I just need to know, I ask him what it's like to learn that I stalked him. Is there anything I found that he wishes I didn't know? Does he feel different about me? About us? Only one of his answers shocks me. He has never seen the interview with his mother. He didn't know it existed online. He knew that his mother had done an interview for that organization, but he thought it was for their internal archives. I ask if he worries that other patients might come across it, and he sits back and takes a breath. For the first time, I see his forehead scrunch up. I don't know, he says after a beat. I'll have to think about it. Frankl's quote pops into my mind again. He's making space between stimulus and response in order to choose his freedom. Our time is up, so Wendell gives his legs the usual two pats and stands. We head for the exit, but at the threshold I stop. I'm sorry about your father, I say. After all, the jig is up. He knows I know the whole story. Wendell smiles. Thank you. Do you miss him? I ask. Every day, he says. Not a day goes by that I don't miss him. Not a day will go by that I won't miss my father either, I say. He nods and we stand there, thinking about our fathers together. When he steps back to open the door for me, I see a hint of moisture in his eyes. There's so much more I want to ask him. Is he at peace with where things were left when his father collapsed? I think about the ways in which sons and fathers can get tangled up in expectations and yearnings for approval. Did his father ever tell him he was proud of him? Not despite his rejecting the family business and carving out his own path, but because of it. I won't learn more about Wendell's father, but we'll have many discussions in the coming weeks and months about mine. And through these discussions, it will become clear that by seeking a male therapist, I'd hoped to get an objective opinion on the breakup. But instead, I got a version of my father. Because my father, too, shows me how it feels to be exquisitely seen. Chapter 41. Integrity versus Despair. Rita is sitting across from me in her smart slacks and sensible shoes, giving a detailed commentary on why her life is hopeless. Her session, like most of her sessions, feels like a dirge, which is all the more confounding because between bouts of insisting that nothing will ever change, she has been making changes both minute and monumental. Back when she and Myron were friends, pre-Randy, Myron had made Rita a website so that she could catalog her art online. This way, he said, She could keep her pieces organized and also share them with others. But Rita didn't think she needed a website. "Who's going to look at it?" she asked. "I will," Myron said. 3 weeks later, Rita had a website with exactly one visitor. Well, two if you counted Rita, who, truth be told, loved it. It looked so professional. Those first weeks, she spent hours each day clicking around on her site, coming up with ideas for new projects, imagining them on display. But her excitement waned when Myron started dating Randy. Why bother posting anything new now? She didn't know how to work the darn thing anyway. Then, one afternoon, Rita ran into Myron and Randy holding hands in the lobby. And to make herself feel better, she hightailed it to the art supply store and splurged on materials. Carrying the goods up to her apartment, she tripped over a couple of kids who darted out from nowhere. The bags of brushes, acrylics, and gouaches, the canvases and cartons of clay, all of it came tumbling down along with Rita, who was caught at the last second by a strong pair of hands. The hands belonged to the kid's father, Kyle, whom Rita had seen many times through her peephole but had never met. He was the dad from the Hello Family apartment across from hers, and he'd saved his neighbor from a potential broken hip. After Kyle asked the kids to apologize for not looking where they were going, they all gathered up Rita's supplies and carried them into her apartment. There, in her living room turned art studio, they saw Rita's work covering the entire space. Portraits and abstracts on easels, ceramics near a potter's wheel, charcoals in progress hanging from a board on the wall. The kids were in heaven, and Kyle was stunned. "You have talent," he said, "real talent. You should sell these." They went back to their apartment, and shortly after, when Kyle's wife Anna arrived home, "Hello, family." The kids begged their mom to go across the hall with them to see the art lady's living room. Rita was stationed, as usual, at the peephole, and the knock came before Rita had a chance to back away. She counted to five, asked, "Who is it?" and greeted them with mock surprise. Soon, Rita was teaching art to Sophia and Alice, ages 5 and 7, and often joined the Hello family for, well, family dinner. One afternoon, Anna came home and yelled, "Hello, family," to Sophia and Alice, who were painting in Rita's living room. The kids called back, "Hello," and then Alice turned to Rita and asked why she didn't answer when their mom said hello. "I'm not family," Rita said matter-of-factly, to which Alice replied, "Yes, you are. You're our California grandma." The girls' grandparents lived in Charleston and Portland. They visited often, but it was Rita who saw them nearly every day. Anna, meanwhile, had hung one of Rita's paintings over the sofa in the family's living room. Rita also painted two custom pieces for the kids' room, a dancer for Sophia and a unicorn for Alice. The girls were elated. Anna tried to pay Rita for her work, but Rita refused, insisting they were gifts. Finally, Kyle, a computer programmer, convinced Rita to let him add a feature to her website, an online store. He sent out an email to the parents of Sophia's and Alice's classmates, and soon Rita was taking orders for children's custom portraits. One parent also purchased ceramics for her dining room. Given all of these developments, I had expected Rita's mood to improve. She was coming alive, leading a less constricted life. She had people to talk to every day. She was sharing her artistic talent with others who admired it. She wasn't invisible in the same way she'd been when she first came to see me. But still, her pleasure or joy or whatever she felt. "It's nice, I suppose," was the most she would say. Lived beneath a dark cloud, a running litany of how if Myron really meant what he'd said in the parking lot at the Y, he would have dated Rita instead of that disgusting Randy in the first place. How no matter how kind they were, the Hello family weren't really her family. How she would still die alone. She seemed to be stuck in what the psychologist Eric Erickson termed despair. In the mid-1900s, Erickson came up with 8 stages of psychosocial development that still guide therapists in their thinking today. Unlike Freud's stages of psychosexual development, which end at puberty and focus on the id, Erickson's psychosocial stages focus on personality development in a social context, such as how infants develop a sense of trust in others. Most important, Erickson stages continue throughout the entire lifespan, and each interrelated stage involves a crisis that we need to get through to move on to the next. They look like this. Infant. Hope. Trust versus mistrust. Toddler. Will. Autonomy versus shame. Preschooler. Purpose. Initiative versus guilt. School-age child. Competence. Industry versus inferiority. Adolescent. Fidelity. Identity versus role confusion. Young adult. Love. Intimacy versus isolation. Middle-aged adult. Care. Generativity versus stagnation. Older adult. Wisdom. Integrity versus despair. The eighth stage is where people Rita's age generally find themselves. Erickson maintained that in later years, we experience a sense of integrity if we believe we have lived meaningful lives. This sense of integrity gives us a feeling of completeness so that we can better accept our approaching deaths. But if we have unresolved regrets about the past, if we think that we made poor choices or failed to accomplish important goals, we feel depressed and hopeless, which leads us to despair. It seemed to me that Rita's current despair about Myron was tied to an old despair, and that was why it was hard for her to enjoy any of the ways her life had expanded. She was used to viewing the world from a place of deficit, and as a result, joy felt foreign to her. If you're used to feeling abandoned, if you already know what it's like for people to disappoint or reject you, well, it may not feel good, but at least there are no surprises. You know the customs in your own homeland. Once you step into foreign territory, though, if you spend time with reliable people who find you appealing and interesting, you might feel anxious and disoriented. All of a sudden, nothing's familiar. You have no landmarks, nothing to go by, and all of the predictability of the world you're used to is gone. The place you came from may not be great. It might, in fact, be pretty awful, but you knew exactly what you'd get there. Disappointment, chaos, isolation, criticism. I've talked about this with Rita, about how for so much of her life she wanted not to be invisible, to be seen. And now this was happening, in her relationship with her neighbors, in the people who bought her art, and in Myron's declaration of his romantic interest. These people enjoyed her company, admired her, desired her, saw her. And yet she seemed unable to acknowledge that anything positive was happening. Are you waiting for the other shoe to drop? I ask. There's a term for this irrational fear of joy. Cherophobia. Chero is the Greek word for rejoice. People with cherophobia are like Teflon pans in terms of pleasure. It doesn't stick. Though pain cakes on them as if to an ungreased surface. It's common for people with traumatic histories to expect disaster just around the corner. Instead of leaning into the goodness that comes their way, they become hypervigilant, always waiting for something to go wrong. That might be why Rita still fumbled for tissues in her purse, even though she knew a fresh box was beside her on the table. Better not to get used to a full box of tissues, or a surrogate family next door, or people purchasing your art, or the man you're dreaming about giving you a big fat kiss in the parking lot. Don't delude yourself, sister. The second you get too comfortable, whoosh, it will all go away. For Rita, joy isn't pleasure. It's anticipatory pain. Rita looks up at me, nodding. Exactly, she says. The other shoe always drops. It did when she got to college, when she married an alcoholic, when she had two more chances at love and those went out the window too. It did when her father died and she finally, started to have a relationship with her mother, only to have her mother diagnosed with Alzheimer's, after which Rita had to care for this woman who no longer recognized her for 12 long years. Of course, Rita didn't have to bring her mother into her apartment during those years. She chose to because somehow her misery served her. At the time, it never occurred to her to ask if she had an obligation to take care of her mother when her mother hadn't taken care of her while she was growing up. She didn't grapple with that toughest of tough questions. What do I owe my parents? And what do they owe me? She could have gotten outside help for her mother. Rita considers this as we talk, but then she says that if she had to do it over, she'd do it all the same. I got what I deserved, she explains. She deserves this misery for all of her crimes, ruining her kids' lives, lacking compassion for her second husband's grief, never getting her own life together. What feels horrible to her are her recent glimmers of happiness. She feels like a fraud, like somebody who won the lottery but stole the ticket. If the people who have come into her life lately really knew her, they would be disgusted. They would run for the hills. She's disgusted. And even if she were to somehow fool them for a time, a few months, a year, who knows? How can she be happy when her kids are so sad? And because of her? That doesn't seem fair, does it? How can someone have done something so awful and still be asking for love? This, she says, is why there's no hope for her. She balls up a tissue in her hand. Too much has happened. Too many mistakes were made. I look at Rita and notice how young she appears as she tells me this. Her cheeks puffed out, her arms folded across her chest. I picture her as a girl in her childhood home, her red hair pulled back neatly with a headband, wondering if she was at fault for her parents' distance from her, brooding over it alone in her room. Are they mad at me? Have I done something to upset them, to cause them to take so little interest in me? They'd waited so long to finally have a child. Had she not lived up to what they had hoped for? I think, too, of Rita's four children. Of their father, the lawyer, who could be so fun one minute and drunk and abusive the next. Of their mother, Rita, removed, making excuses for their father, offering promises on his behalf that they knew were lies. How confusing and harrowing their childhoods must have been. How furious they must be now. How they must not want to deal with their mother coming to them, as she had several times over the years, crying and begging for a relationship. Whatever she wants, they'd likely think, it was for one reason and one reason only. For her sake. Always for her sake. My guess was that Rita's children wouldn't talk to her, because they couldn't give her the one thing she seemed to want, even if she'd never asked for it directly. Forgiveness. Rita and I had talked about why she hadn't protected her children, why she'd let her husband hit them, why she'd spent her time reading or painting or playing tennis or bridge instead of being present for them. And once we got past the explanation she'd given herself for years, we arrived at something she hadn't been aware of. Rita envied her children. Rita wasn't unusual in this. Take the case of a mother who came from a household with little money, and who now admonishes her child every time she gets a new pair of shoes or a new toy by saying, "Don't you realize how lucky you are?" A gift wrapped in a criticism. Or consider the father who takes his son to visit prospective colleges and spends the entire tour of the college that he himself dreamed of attending but was rejected from, making negative comments about the tour guide, the curriculum, the dorms. Not only embarrassing his son, but possibly hurting his chances of admission. Why do parents do this? Often they envy their children's childhoods, the opportunities they have, the financial or emotional stability that the parents provide, the fact that their children have their whole lives ahead of them, a stretch of time that's now in the parents' past. They strive to give their children all the things they themselves didn't have. But they sometimes end up, without even realizing it, resenting the kids for their good fortune. Rita envied her kids their siblings, their comfortable childhood home with the pool, their opportunities to go to museums and travel. She envied their young, energetic parents. And it was, in part, her unconscious envy, her fury at the unfairness of it all, that kept her from allowing them to have the happy childhood she didn't, that kept her from saving them in the way she so badly wanted to be saved when she was young. I brought up Rita in my consultation group. Despite her gloomy, Eeyore-like exterior, I told my colleagues she was warm and interesting, and because I was free of the history her kids shared with her, I could enjoy Rita the way I'd enjoy a friend of a parent. I liked her quite a bit. But could her children really be expected to forgive her? Did I forgive her? The group asked. I thought of my son and felt sick at the idea of anyone hitting him, of my ever allowing that to happen. I wasn't sure. Forgiveness is a tricky thing, in the way that apologies can be. Are you apologizing because it makes you feel better, or because it will make the other person feel better? Are you sorry for what you've done, or are you simply trying to placate the other person who believes you should be sorry for the thing you feel completely justified in having done? Who is the apology for? There's a term we use in therapy, forced forgiveness. Sometimes people feel that in order to get past a trauma, they need to forgive whoever caused the damage. The parent who sexually assaulted them, the burglar who robbed their house, the gang member who killed their son. They're told by well-meaning people that until they can forgive, they'll hold on to the anger. Granted, for some, forgiveness can serve as a powerful release. You forgive the person who wronged you without condoning his actions, and it allows you to move on. But too often, people feel pressured to forgive and then end up believing that something's wrong with them if they can't quite get there, that they aren't enlightened enough or strong enough or compassionate enough. So what I say is this: you can have compassion without forgiving. There are many ways to move on, and pretending to feel a certain way isn't one of them. I once had a client named Dave who had a problematic relationship with his father. His father was, by his account, a bully, demeaning, critical, and full of himself. He had alienated both of his sons from a young age and had a distant and contentious relationship with them as adults. When his father was dying, Dave was 50 years old, married with children of his own, and he struggled with what to say at his father's funeral. What would ring true? And then he told me that as his father lay on his deathbed, he had reached out for his son's hand and said, out of the blue, "I wish I'd treated you better. I was a prick." Dave was livid. Did his father expect absolution now at the 11th hour? The time to make repairs, he felt, was long before you left this earth, not on the eve of your departure. You don't automatically get the gift of closure or forgiveness from a deathbed confession. He couldn't help himself. "I don't forgive you," Dave told his dad. He hated himself for saying this, regretted it the second it came out. But after all the pain his father had put him through, and all the work he'd done to create a good life for himself and his family, he'd be damned if he was going to soothe his father now with a sugary lie. He'd spent his childhood lying about how he felt. Still, Dave wondered, what kind of person says this to his dying father? Dave had started to apologize, but his father interrupted him. "I understand," he said. "If I were you, I wouldn't forgive me either." And then the strangest thing happened, Dave told me. Sitting there, holding his father's hand, Dave felt something shift. He felt, for the first time in his life, genuine compassion. Not forgiveness, but compassion. Compassion for the sad, dying man who must have had his own pain. And it was that compassion that allowed Dave to speak authentically at his father's funeral. It was compassion, too, that helped me help Rita. I didn't have to forgive her for what she'd done with her children. As with Dave's father, that was up to Rita to reckon with. We may want others' forgiveness, but that comes from a place of self-gratification. We are asking forgiveness of others to avoid the harder work of forgiving ourselves. I thought of something Wendell had said to me after I'd listed my own regrettable missteps that I took great pleasure in punishing myself for. "How long do you think the sentence for this crime should be? A year? 5? 10? Many of us torture ourselves over our mistakes for decades, even after we've genuinely attempted to make amends. How reasonable is that sentence? It's true that in Rita's case, her children's lives were significantly affected by their parents' failures. She and her children would always feel the pain of their shared pasts. But shouldn't there be some redemption? Did Rita deserve to be persecuted day after day, year after year? I wanted to be realistic about the considerable scars they all bore, but I didn't want to be Rita's warden. I can't help but think about her evolving relationship with the Hello Family girls next door. What if she had been able to offer her four children what she offers them? I put the question to Rita. What should your sentence be, as you approach 70, for the crimes you committed in your 20s and 30s? They were significant crimes, yes. But you've felt remorse for decades, and you've tried to make repairs. Shouldn't you have been released by now, or at least out on parole? What do you think is a fair sentence for your crimes? Rita considers this for a moment. Life in prison, she says. Well, I say, that's what you got. But I'm not sure that a jury that included Myron or the Hello family would agree. But the people I care about most, my kids, they'll never forgive me. I nod. We don't know what they're going to do. But it doesn't help them in any way for you to be miserable. Your misery doesn't change their situation. You can't lessen their misery by carrying it for them inside you. It doesn't work that way. There are ways for you to be a better mother to them at this point in all of your lives. Sentencing yourself to life in prison isn't one of them. I notice that I have Rita's attention. There's only one person in this entire world who benefits from you not being able to enjoy anything good in your life. Rita's forehead becomes a series of lines. Who? You, I say. I point out to her that pain can be protective. Staying in a depressed place can be a form of avoidance. Safe inside her shell of pain, she doesn't have to face anything, nor does she have to emerge into the world, where she might get hurt again. Her inner critic serves her. I don't have to take any action because I'm worthless. And there's another benefit to her misery. She may feel that she stays alive in her kids' minds if they relish her suffering. At least somebody has her in mind, even in a negative way. And in this sense, she's not completely forgotten. She looks up from her tissue, as if considering the pain that she's carried for decades in an entirely new way. For maybe the first time, Rita seems to see the crisis she has been in the midst of, the battle between what Eric Erickson called integrity and despair. Which, I wonder, will she choose? Chapter 42. My Neshama. I'm at lunch with my colleague Caroline. We're catching up, talking about our practices, when Caroline asks if the Wendell referral she gave me a while back ever worked out for my friend. As an aside, she says that our call brought back memories from when she and Wendell were in graduate school together. A classmate of theirs had a massive crush on him, but it wasn't reciprocated. And Wendell actually started dating another. Whoa! I stop her. I can't hear this. The referral, I admit, was for me. Caroline looks shocked for a second. And then she laughs, and iced tea begins spurting from her nose. Sorry, she says, wiping her face with a napkin. I thought I was referring a married guy to him. I just can't imagine you with Wendell. I understand what she means. It's hard to envision somebody you know as the patient of somebody else you know, especially if you knew that person back in graduate school. You know too much about both of them. I tell her I was ashamed back then, about my breakup, my book fiasco, my health issues, and she shares her own struggles with trying to conceive a second child. Near the end of our lunch, she also tells me about a difficult patient and how she had no idea during the initial consultation how difficult this patient would be, how abrasive, demanding, entitled. I have one too, I say, thinking about John. But over time, I've come to like him quite a bit, to care about him deeply. I hope mine works out that way, Caroline says. Then, an afterthought. But if not, could I send her to you? Do you have the time? I can tell from her tone that she's kidding. Mostly. I remember talking to my consultation group early on about John and his enormous ego and constant put-downs. Ian had quipped, "Well, if it doesn't work out, just make sure you refer him to somebody you dislike." Oh, no, I say now, shaking my head. Don't send her to me. Then I'll refer her to Wendell, Caroline says, and we laugh. So, I say to Wendell the following Wednesday morning, I had lunch with Caroline last week. He's silent, but his magnet eyes are on me. I start telling him how Caroline felt about her patient, and how sometimes I feel that way about patients, how every therapist does, but still, I say, it bothers me. Are we judging people too harshly? Do we not have enough empathy? I can't pinpoint why, I continue. But I felt strange about that conversation all week. It makes me uncomfortable in a way it hadn't at lunch, and... Wendell's brow is furrowed, as though he's trying to follow my train of thought. I think as a profession, I say, attempting to clarify. We can't keep it all inside. But at the same time, do you have a question for me? Wendell asks, interrupting. I realize I do. I have many. Does Wendell talk about me with his colleagues at lunch? Do I still feel to him like my patient Becca felt to me before I stopped seeing her? Wendell had used the singular, though, not, do you have questions for me, but do you have a question for me? He did that, I recognize, because all of my questions boil down to an essential one, a question so loaded that I don't know how to say it aloud. Is there anything that makes us feel more vulnerable than asking someone, do you like me? It seems that being a therapist hasn't made me immune to responding to Wendell in the ways that patients respond to me. I get frustrated with him. I resent being charged for a cancellation when I'm sick, even though I have the same cancellation policy. I don't always tell him everything I should, and I unwittingly, or wittingly, distort what he says. I've always assumed that when Wendell closed his eyes in our sessions, it was to give him space to think something through. But now I wonder if it's more of a reset button. Perhaps he's saying to himself, have compassion, have compassion, have compassion, the way I used to do with John. Like most patients, I want my therapist to enjoy my company and have respect for me. But ultimately, I want to matter to him. Feeling deep in your cells that you matter is part of the alchemy that takes place in good therapy. The humanistic psychologist Carl Rogers practiced what he called client-centered therapy, a central tenet of which was unconditional positive regard. His switch from using the term patient to client was representative of his attitude toward the people he worked with. Rogers believed that a positive therapist-client relationship was an essential part of the cure, not just a means to an end, a groundbreaking concept when he introduced it in the mid-20th century. But unconditional positive regard doesn't mean the therapist necessarily likes the client. It means that the therapist is warm and non-judgmental, and most of all, genuinely believes in the client's ability to grow if nurtured in an encouraging and accepting environment. It's a framework for valuing and respecting the person's right to determination, even if her choices are at odds with yours. Unconditional positive regard is an attitude, not a feeling. I want more than Wendell's unconditional positive regard. I want him to like me. My question, it turns out, isn't only about discovering whether I matter to Wendell. It's also about acknowledging how much he matters to me. Do you like me? I squeak out, feeling pathetic and awkward. I mean, what can he possibly say? He's not going to say no. Even if he doesn't like me, he could throw it back to me by saying, what do you think? Or, I wonder why you're asking this now. Or he could say what I might have said to John if he'd asked me this question early on. I would have told him the truth of my experience, which might have been less about whether I liked him and more about how hard it was to get to know him when he kept me at arm's length. But Wendell does none of that. I do like you, he says, in a way that makes me feel he means it. It sounds neither rote nor gushy. It's so simple and so unexpectedly moving in its simplicity. Yes, I like you. I like you too, I say, and Wendell smiles. Wendell says that while I want to be liked for being smart or funny, he was talking about liking my neshama, which is the Hebrew word for spirit or soul. The concept registers instantly. I tell Wendell about a recent college graduate who, considering a career as a therapist, asked if I liked my patients, because after all, that's who therapists spend their time with each day. I said that sometimes patients seem one way on the outside, but that's often because they're confusing me with others from their past who may not have seen them the way I do. Even so, I told this young woman, I feel genuine affection for my patients all the time. Their tender places, their bravery, their souls. For, as Wendell is saying, their neshamot. But in a professional way, right? The young woman persisted. And I knew that she didn't quite understand. Because before I met my patients, I didn't understand either. And as a patient myself, it was hard to remember. But Wendell has just reminded me. Chapter 43. What not to say to a dying person. That's not a thing, Julie says. She's talking about a coworker who had a miscarriage, a fellow cashier at Trader Joe's, and how another coworker, trying to console her, said, "Everything happens for a reason. This one just wasn't meant to be." "Everything happens for a reason" is not a thing, Julie repeats. There's no divine plan if you miscarry or have cancer, or your child is murdered by a lunatic. I know what she means. People make misguided comments about all kinds of misfortune. And Julie has been toying with the idea of writing a book she plans to call What Not to Say to a Dying Person, a guide for the well-meaning but clueless. According to Julie, here are a few things not to say. Are you sure you're dying? Have you gotten a second opinion? Be strong. What are your odds? You need to be less stressed. It's all about attitude. You can beat this. I know somebody who took vitamin K and was cured. I read about this new therapy that shrinks tumors. In mice, but still. You really have no family history of this? If Julie did, the person asking would feel safer. It could be explained by genetics. The other day, someone told Julie, I knew a woman who had the same kind of cancer as you. Knew? Julie said. Yes, the person replied sheepishly. She died. As Julie goes through her list of things not to say, I think about other patients who've complained about comments people make at various difficult times. You can still have another child. At least he lived a long life. She's in a better place now. When you're ready, you can always get another dog. It's been a year. Maybe it's time to move on. To be sure, these comments are meant to comfort. But they're also a way of protecting the speakers from the uncomfortable feelings that somebody else's bad situation stirs up. Platitudes like these make a terrible circumstance more palatable for the person saying the words, but leave the person experiencing the adversity feeling angry and alone. People think that if they talk about me dying, it'll become a reality when it already is a reality, Julie says, shaking her head. I've seen this to be true too, and not just about death. Not speaking about something doesn't make it less real. It makes it scarier. For Julie, the worst thing is the silence. People who avoid her so that they don't have to get into a conversation and say those awkward things in the first place. She'd choose awkward over ignored. What do you wish people would say? I ask. Julie thinks about this. They can say, I'm so sorry. They can say, how can I be helpful? Or, I feel so helpless, but I care about you. She shifts on the couch, her thinner frame not quite filling out her clothes. They can be honest, she continues. One person blurted out, I have no idea how to say the right thing here. And I was so relieved. I told her that before I got sick, I wouldn't have known what to say either. At work, when my grad students first heard, they all said, what will we do without you? And that felt good, because it was an expression of how they feel about me. People have said, no, and I'm always a phone call away if you want to talk or just go do something fun. They remember that I'm still me, that I'm still their friend and not just a cancer patient, and they can talk to me about their relationships and work and the latest episode of Game of Thrones. One thing that has surprised Julie about going through the process of watching herself die is how vivid her world has become. Everything that she used to take for granted produces a sense of revelation, as if she were a child again. Tastes. The sweetness of a strawberry, its juice dripping onto her chin. A buttery pastry melting in her mouth. Smells. Flowers on a front lawn, a colleague's perfume, seaweed washed up on the shore. Matt's sweaty body in bed at night. Sounds. The strings on a cello, the screech of a car. Her nephew's laughter. Experiences. Dancing at a birthday party. People watching at Starbucks. Buying a cute dress. Opening the mail. All of this, no matter how mundane, delights her to no end. She's become hyper-present. When people delude themselves into believing they have all the time in the world, she's noticed, they get lazy. She hadn't expected to experience this pleasure in her grief, to find it invigorating, in a way. But even as she's dying, she's realized, life goes on. Even as the cancer invades her body, she still checks Twitter. At first she thought, why would I waste even 10 minutes of the time I have left checking Twitter? And then she thought, why wouldn't I? I like Twitter. She also tries not to dwell on what she's losing. I can breathe fine now, Julie says. But it'll get harder, and I'll grieve for that. Until then, I breathe. Julie gives more examples of what helps when she tells people she's dying. A hug is great, she says. So is I love you. My absolute favorite is just a plain, I love you. Did anyone say that? I ask. Matt did, she says. When they found out she had cancer, his first words